Just one announcement. Tonight, if you have the energy, we'll do some sitting a little later than usual. So, at the end of the 9 o'clock sit. Maybe that's the end of the day, and if you wish, we'll come back at, or anyone who wants, especially if you hate yourself a little bit. Like I do. Just a touch, just a smidge. Come back at 10, and we'll sit, walk, until midnight or so. And yeah, anyway, sometimes that's good. So very, very sweet to be meeting with you all, and I'm very, very kind of struck by how much we all share, what's shared and what's different, and how much each of your presence brings a kind of different constellation in of myself into the room, you know. So with some of you, it feels, you know, just kind of mirroring your energy. I'm just kind of quiet, or even with my eyes closed, or sometimes more playful or serious, or sometimes totally non-directive, and other times quite, you know, pointed in the suggestions. And it would be totally inappropriate to like be the same person, say the same things to each of you. It would be like, yeah, Buddhist malpractice, you know. But that's one-on-one, and in a Dharma talk, kind of have to say the same thing to all of you, yeah? And so your job is to kind of actually take it in whatever way you see fit. And some, you know, with Dharma talks, some of it is meant to be just readily a kind of accessible, and some of it to stretch the mind in some way, to point to some possibilities. So this present moment, the instruction to be present, and the question, like, what is the present moment? Is that a moment of time? Sometimes when we say to be present, what we mean is to not be identified with thought. Yeah, to not be lost in the realm of thought. That being present is anything but that, essentially. As the awareness becomes less fixated, as it stops getting kind of snagged on phenomena, thoughts and feelings, sounds, as it stops getting snagged on phenomena, it's like it... It touches and releases experience more gracefully It's a very light touch, the awareness. And so as we settle in, it can start to feel like the moment is getting shorter and shorter. There's a mural in, I think it's Berlin, and the question is, it says, how long is now? How long is now? Yeah. And in this path, we hear a lot about resisting the seductions of time, stepping outside of time, of letting go of past and future, and being being present. But I want to suggest that our practice is so much about memory and about making the future less intimidating. Our practice really honors and transforms past and future. And we do this not by solving some riddle, figuring out something, but by allowing memory, planning, worry, by allowing past and future to fully arise in the present moment and to expose the heart to all of it. We so often in practice want to technique our way out of suffering, you know? And there's, of course, a place for technique, and the Buddha gave us a kind of map, you know, for what experience is, how to even approach it. You know, it's like really helpful. And to some extent, the process that I'm going to describe is not something we have to do or implement solve, but actually a way of relating with deep tolerance to the arising of memory and planning. And so I sometimes, you know, kid that when we, you know, if we're doing like weight training or something and trying to get like stronger biceps, we don't like do a rep and then like look over and just be like, are we doing it? You know, like, but in our practice, we basically like do the rep and then have like a long heart to heart with our bicep. Yeah. And a lot of the practice is kind of just surrendering to the logic of the Dharma, the logic of healing, the logic of retreat. Yeah. And that's not something we have to understand. There's just this gesture of surrender, of faith, maybe. So from his memoir of recollections of surviving the Holocaust that took much of his family, Elie Wiesel in Night, says, in the end, it is all about memory, its sources and its magnitude, and, of course, its consequences. The work of memory, the work of memory. This is happens as the at the individual level, but also the necessity of doing this at the societal level, like the willingness of a nation to remember its past. In a way, this country, it's like our national self-esteem, self-image is so fragile because we've been unwilling to actually deeply remember. And this parallels the kind of inner process in a person. And so this question of memory that we know so well, just what happens to us as we sit, as we walk. This question of memory intersects with a lot of deep kind of Dharma inquiries of the questions of thinking and healing and self and suffering. So scientist Kalina Kristoff asked the question, what lures us into thought? The moment before we get a thought actually arises, she asked the question, what is happening at the level of the brain? And so what she did is she got a bunch of meditators from the Mahasi tradition, the Burmese Mahasi tradition, and asked them, was doing brain scans and was asking for them to indicate when a thought arose, and relying on their kind of introspective capacity to detect this, yeah? And then looking, okay, the thought arose at this moment, what was the brain like in those seconds before that thought, yeah? And what she found was, you know, as complex findings, that I don't want to get into or even fully understand, but what she said was the brain regions that were active, she described in those moments before thought arose, is she said brain regions associated with reactivation and recombination of memory traces. Yeah. Like, maybe sometimes you can almost feel it, like something gets, it's like the embryonic stage of thought, you can, like something gets stirred, yeah? And where the beginning of that thought is, who knows, but there's a sense of that kind of subtle pull of something, yeah? Maybe subtle trace of memory. When we talk about memory, memories are not so much, you know, accessed, like going into a kind of file drawer and like pulling out the piece of paper or something, they're constructed, yeah? So the psychiatrist Yalom said, that sort of therapeutic success is giving up hope for a better past, yeah? But the work of being present deeply transforms how we construct the past. Yeah. So it's not like we just have to accept the narrative that we've always told, the story we've always told. Yeah. But instead, as I'll unpack, it's like practice changes how we construct our story. We remember, you know, like when we remember, our memories in a way are shaped by the level of wisdom we had when that happened. Yeah. And it kind of gets frozen a little bit the view was not infused with Dharma. And so how we understand what happened is, it can be stuck in a way. And so we remember in a way from some maybe deluded point of view. Philip Roth says, we don't just forget things because they don't matter, but also forget things because they matter too much. Each of us remembers and forgets in a pattern whose labyrinthine windings are an identification mark no less distinctive than a fingerprint. It's like maybe we can get some intuitive hit of just really loosening the grip of the autobiography. The peculiarity of how we tell the story of me, of how we remember and construe our past, and how we construe ourself. Because so much of the self is bound up with memory. In some ways, our identity is the sum of our memories. And as we start to get stiller and quieter, as we start to dwell more in emptiness, it's not that memories vanish, but they cease to refer back to me in the same way. They're mine and not mine. Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, the present, like what's actually here, what's given here, is not a radical break from the past in some ways. What's here, like what's right here, this pain, this joy, this stillness, this heartache, it is an expression of the past. The present is composed of the past. And so Thich Nhat Hanh says, if you're a poet, you'll see clearly that there's a cloud floating in this sheet of paper. Without a cloud, there will be no rain. Without rain, trees cannot grow. Without trees, we cannot make paper. So we can say that the cloud and the paper inter are. Looking even more deeply, we can see that we are in it too. When we look at a sheet of paper, the sheet of paper is part of our perception. Your mind is in here, and mine is also. So we can say that everything is in here with this sheet of paper. You cannot point out one thing that's not here. Time, space, the earth, rain, minerals, sunshine, the cloud, the river, the heat. This sheet of paper is because everything else is. So if that's a sheet of paper, what are you? Take ourselves to be so static, independent. Early in practice, what happened is that my autobiography became unconvincing, you know, like that kind of compulsive narration of who, what I am, where I came from, what makes me good, bad, all of it. Like I was so kind of startled by the, you know, the level of activity, of chaos in the mind, emotionally, you know, just in seeing that for the first time up close. I was so startled by that that it kind of cast a shadow of doubt over, like, yeah, who I thought I was. And that's a good thing. That's a moment of openness to actually call into question the sanctity of our autobiography. To begin to, to wonder how we've knit that the story of self together. Freud said that which we cannot remember, we're doomed to repeat. That something about the avoidance or repression, that which actually can't make its way fully into awareness, be experienced, be re-experienced, distorts us in some way. Ajahn Sajito put it differently. He said, what we don't listen to, we become. What we don't listen to, we become. I'm close with my brother, who's a couple years younger than I am. But it was not always that way. I don't remember this, but my uncle told me a story when I was like maybe three or something. It was like a family party, and my brother, who is a year and a half or so, almost 2 years younger, he was at the party too. Yeah. So, and anyway, at this particular party, he learned how to sit up. And apparently, as the story goes, the whole party kind of stopped and was celebrating my brother. And yeah, and I could walk. It's like, please. So I can only imagine my mind state, but there's just like people just cheering him on. And then I turn to my uncle and I say, me knock Gregory down. And I just run and tackle him. Just, yeah. That's one of the nicer stories of the sibling rivalry. I bring it up because in the course of practice, like, that is like a, you know, kind of funny now or playful or whatever, but there's like a lot of, like, when I actually thought of, oh, some of the harm that I did, you know, as we were, you know, teenagers, or just the jealousy, the competition, the kind of pain of that, the kind of my capacity for cruelty. Like, of course, this is undigested. And so I started sitting, and of course it comes back. Yeah. And in a way, like, what is really undigested, it gets lodged as a certain kind of memory, yeah? A certain kind of sense of incompletion when we're sort of, yeah, it sticks in a different way. And a lot of this is around harm we perpetrate, harm we suffer. Yeah. And part of our practice is about digesting our past, And how is this actually done? I don't think it's so much by consciously trying to review life or something, but it's sitting and being willing to feel the brunt of memory and to let it unwind in the kind of open heart. Oh. And a lot of this entails a kind of equanimity with emotion, you know, the emotional kind of residue of memory. And so there's memory and there are habits, old habits. And just to be here, just to stay, just to keep going, is to begin the process of transformation, to actually be willing to remember, to re-experience. And so a lot of the kind of offer, the invitation of retreat is actually like, how does habit re-emerge? How do I act out my habits in this microcosm? Yeah. And we are not trying to counter it or correct ourselves, but just willing to actually experience the energy of memory and habit unwinding like bound wire in the heart, and then it just starts to unfurl. And there's not so much like a kind of intervention, this is what I must do, I must fix this. But it's like something starts to happen where some of the emotional charge of memory, of habit, starts to just settle. And so, in this sense, practice is a way of remembering and blessing our past with the Dharma. Yeah. Blessing our past with the Dharma, blessing our habits, our memory with wisdom and love. And this is as if we're like blessing and forgiving all of our former selves. Just all of them. 3-year-old, teenager, all of it. Yeah. And we can... It's like the Dharma starts to infuse itself in our sense of the past, our sense of memory. And we're not consciously trying to author this, yeah? But we start to rewrite our autobiography. The silence starts to rewrite our autobiography. And this doesn't mean we ignore pain or the wounds or the injustice, or it doesn't mean ignoring anything. It's just like almost this alchemical process of exposing it to the light of awareness, the openness of the heart. And so the capacity to actually tell our story, to speak of our past, and to speak of it in a way that feels, is infused with Dharma, like that's an accomplishment of practice. Yeah. And it happens without us having to do the writing ourselves. We just stay. So the past and the future here, Kazuo Koreeda, Japanese director, who movie from 20 years ago, Afterlife. Think about often the story of this kind of almost kind of purgatory, where the people who have recently died go, and they're there for some week or so, and what they're tasked with is to pick one memory from their life that is most precious to them, and then they recreate and film that memory. And upon the viewing, yeah, the show, the film, the screening of the film, which they watch, they vanish into that moment for all eternity. Yeah. Early in practice, I got the instruction to sit like a dying person, like I was dying, and that was deeply meaningful, because I was always so afraid of death, and almost felt like through the kind of generations, a kind of even more than the ordinary anxiety about mortality. But so it was very poignant insofar as it reminds us of like the preciousness of our life. But there's another dimension of an instruction like that, which is that to imagine life without a future. Just as Koreeda, like that of vanishing into the moment, and that moment is the only life we could ever know. What would it be like to be alive, but without future? So much of our mental and emotional life is structured around the future, around like staying alive, making sure things are okay. And so many of our thoughts, we can see our thoughts and worries and planning. It's like, okay, this talk will end, there'll be a walk, there'll be dinner, I'm going to rest. The evening is short. I'm just going to nail that. You know, I don't hate myself, so I'm just going to go to bed. And then, you know, it's like we were like budgeting pleasure and energy and pain and like so much kind of just the uncertainty, the anxiety of just what's to come. It's like, okay, we'll just scaffold things and make time feel more bearable. And so much of it is just animated by this, like, we don't ask it consciously, but will I be okay? Yeah. Is my future... will I have a future? And so in this way, mortality feels like, to me, like the anxiety that binds together all the other anxieties, you know. So philosopher Metzinger says, Our deepest cognitive bias is existence bias, which means that we'll simply do almost anything to prolong our own existence because it is a biological imperative that's been burned into our nervous systems over millennia. It's hard to underestimate the relevance of arriving at an analysis of what 2,500 years ago the Buddha called bhava-tanha, the craving for existence. So the Buddha said that we crave sense pleasure, we crave non-existence, and we crave existence, bhava-tanha. And in a way, this wish to stay alive, to keep becoming, it's so innocent. It's like the most innocent wish there is. And of course we do everything we can to cherish that wish, to see that in the eyes of others, to honor that in protecting the most vulnerable, right? We like really honor this wish. But I want to call it into question as a kind of thought experiment, to see the ways in which our insistence of staying alive contorts the present moment. The Buddha said that affliction is always becoming something other. Always becoming something other. That drive in us, always becoming something other. And when our existence is the priority, the mind is compulsively attuned to threat and opportunity. Yeah. What is the threat and where is the opportunity? And we worry so much in part because that's the kind of mechanism through which we try to ensure our security. But what this means is that there's a sense of the present moment is always being a kind of down payment on something next, and we never come to rest fully. And so the question of what would life feel like right now if there were no future? If you were to live this moment, this, for eternity, how deeply would we let go? How open might the mind be? Unafraid because there's nothing next. Because unafraid, freed up, radically freed up. How different might the world look, freed of this wish to become something? And of course, this manifests in practice too. You know, to become enlightened, to become a good practitioner, to become a Buddhist, to become something—kind of that sense of I want to be free, I want to be enlightened. That, in a sense, is delusion because we're imagining freedom from the perspective of self. Yeah. Like me becoming enlightened. That sense of me separated by some gulf of time. And then me then freed in some way. Ajahn Sumedho, the Thai forest tradition, says even these subtle, almost noble desires are bhavatana. We usually conceive of the self as the cause of things, but the Buddha asked us to consider the self as an effect. An effect. An effect of what? Something like fear. In a way, the attempt to stay safe, this most innocent of wishes, the attempt to stay safe, the conditioning, evolutionary conditioning of staying safe, has led us in a way to orchestrate a sense of self. We organize threat and opportunity around this central hub of I am-ness. And so a critical component of practice, of our Dharma practice, is to start to feel more and more safe in our experience. And that, of course, is why, as we've said, why we commit to the precepts, we commit to doing what we can to make all of you, each of you, everything in you, feel as welcome and safe as we can. That's why we ask all of us to be conscious of the Sangha impacts on each other, to be tending to the hearts of others, because this cues something in us that, okay, maybe it's okay to settle in. Maybe it's okay to become a little less preoccupied with orchestrating our survival, our becoming. And so maybe we can notice that the more safe we actually feel in meditation, in or in any moment, not just meditation, the more safe we actually feel, the more the self recedes, the thinner it gets, the less dense it gets. It feels safer to forget oneself. And then maybe something frightens you. There's a loud noise or a pain in the body. Something startles us. And then we kind of find the self becomes louder, denser, heavier. We move back into the corner of self. So we can track this as we move about retreat. How thick does it feel, like this sense of self, this kind of self which maybe we can call a defense in a way. And thoughts, concerns, future, the future arises, planning and imagining and simulating the future, and all of this arises. And can we soothe the body mind? Can we just soothe that? So we permit thoughts of the future to arise and fade, to unwind in the heart. Settle into the stillness, what's given right here. The Buddha students, Sariputra, said, Nibbana freedom is the cessation of becoming. To begin to know this makes us less intimidated by our future. Not denying the relentlessness of time, the march of time, the necessity of planning and all of this. It's not denying any of that. But it is a way of making life actually feel complete. We just like all these rushing river of becoming. It's like we're just allowing it to flow inside our heart, but not following it. Not following its promises. And then we come to know the present moment in a different way, the bottomlessness of the present moment, the protection of the present moment, protection of awareness. The heart comes to feel more complete. The past is more digested. The future, whatever life we have left, is dana. We're all living on borrowed time. Such a gift just to have this breath. To be together in this way. Nothing else has to happen. Ajahn Sajito, our practice is led by Dhamma rather than driven by self-view. Inclines towards relinquishing the old rather than becoming something new. It's a cultivation that frees up, protects, and gathers us into a free space at the center of life.